give it another minute and let everybody else turn up, and then we'll get going. Good morning, everyone. You could mute your microphones, everyone. All right, I'll give it another minute and then we'll get going. Guess I'll just be clicking people into it as we go through it. Thank you.
So I just make sure.
Right, I might get going. Everybody will know that come in at their own time. Thank you for those that are here already. What we'll try and do towards the end is do some questions. So if you'd like to maybe put them into the chat, I can come back to them a little bit later on during the process. Okay. Looks like I might wait another second because everybody's turning up now. All right. So thank you for coming along today. The program is pretty straightforward. It'll be about customized employment discovery, a little bit about theory and practice, what sits behind it, a little bit about the NDIS, a little bit some customized employment NDES. It's very much a conversation with a purpose. So if you could just keep yourself muted we just get going along. I'd like to pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. We celebrate the stories, culture, and traditions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders of all communities who work and live on this land. And let's get going then. Somebody's really in the background. I can hear.
Yeah, thanks.
Why am I not hearing this?
You should be able to hear it because my microphone's working. I can see it working there. Can you hear? Is there any issues with that? Phil, can you hear?
Yes, I'm hearing correct. Fine, Peter.
Okay, all right. So it's not my end then. Okay, thanks, Phil. Right. Let's get going then. Okay, just a little bit of background about myself, I guess, first. As you can see, or would know, that I'm the director founder of the Centre for Disability Employment Research and Practice. And the other bits and pieces, I guess you could read. I hold various roles at different faculties and universities around the world. I have another one popping up next year at another institution overseas where I've been invited to work and research. We started the centre over a decade ago, mainly in response to the fact that the NDIS was coming along. I was doing research at that time at the University of Sydney under my mentor and guide, Trevor Parmenter. and there wasn't didn't seem to be much interest in the universities to really engage with the idea of building the evidence base for disability employment. So we kind of Trevor asked me to wait. At that time, I had been working in the States with Carrie Griffin, who's one of the pioneers of customized employment. I've been working inside organizations and working with Carrie, who was teaching me customized employment.
I'm going to try and change the audio.
If you could please mute, or maybe I'll find that button that mutes for in a minute. And it sort of went from there. And then one of my trips back to Australia, working with Trevor, he asked me to wait, went back, work with Carrie. He said, you'll have to do this yourself. And we did, with a bunch of colleagues outside of the university system, because we didn't want to be a part of the politics of it. But the whole point of it was to build the evidence base and to provide practical guidance, because one of the things a lot of research doesn't do particularly well is it's not accessible to employers, to people who, you know, basically can't understand algebra. What we wanted to do was produce material that allowed people to simply be able to pick it up and go, ah, that's how to do it. And that's always been our ethos, even though we do research and produce peer-reviewed papers. Our real focus is on educating the community, employers, in a manner that's accessible. So we have established research partnerships with a considerable number of universities and leading centres around the world, such as VCU, Utah State, UMass, Cornell, et cetera, et cetera. There's a statement at the bottom there from Paul Wayman, who's a recently retired director of Victoria Commonwealth University, where he noted that most current disability employment practices centered on economic philosophy fail to recognize employment as one part of a larger picture. And too much research today is about admiring the problems and not finding solutions. Some people would disagree with that, but certainly a lot of research really doesn't address the solutions. It talks about the problems. So that's kind of a semi-political statement. I'm sure people have differing opinions. So let's move on. Right, and I'll move that down there. So customized employment itself, let's have a look at it and what sits behind it. The process itself has its origins in the early 80s, and this is not a uniquely American thing in the sense that it was not called customized employment, it was called supported employment, or we call open employment. Supported employment is open employment in the US. And it was taking places in various centers around Oregon, in particular, the University of Oregon, Rob Horner and David Mann, people like that, Virginia with VCU, Montana with people like Carrie Griffin, who's coming out of universities, Vermont, where they really focused a lot on what was then sheltered workshops and moving people into open employment. And that process was taking place in Australia, and largely as a result of the New Directions report, which gave us the, what I guess now is the old Disability Services Act. But there were a range of trials happening in Australia. There was the work prep centres in Sydney that Trevor Pimento and Vivian Richards were trialling. But it was all pretty much based on the same principles, which was to place people in employment and train them. You know, and which is what we really do all the time. And if you think about all of us and our employment is very much place and train. We get a job and we get to go there and learn about that organization and how they do things. I know that when I started in disability employment, I was given a 600-page manual to read, and that was my first week's work. Bizarre, but fascinating. So the early models of open or supported employment were based on around the idea that it followed four basic principles, and that was a rapid placement after a person-centered planning approach, because the earlier, the whole processes of disability employment in the early days were based on the idea of, hopefully I pressed the record button, yes I did, were based on person-centered approaches. And if you've ever watched the video of Carrie and myself, Carrie Griffin and myself talking, and he talks about what he was seeing, was in the earlier versions of what was we now call customized employment, was pretty much just person-centered planning with an emphasis on employment. You know, it was they were doing things like placing people in paid employment by the employer and then training them on site with careful daily monitoring until the individual's competence levels met the thresholds for employment success. And then, of course, post-placement usually coming along and supporting the individual and the employer. And as Paul Wayman has noted here, usually permanently. But of course, you know, these days we've evolved to that point where we really want to fade out. At the same time that this was going on, as the processes of supporting employment were evolving, Robert Drake and Deborah Becker and their group were psychologists who were looking at developing a version of open employment for people with severe psychiatric disabilities. And because they were doing it in clinical settings, they were able to use a higher degree of evidence in their research because they were able to do clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, because in clinical settings, you can have a control group and the group trialing it, the methodology. So in our community, of course, outside of the community, you can't do that. So consequently, they developed what we now know as the Individual Place and Support, or IPS, for people with psychiatric severe to moderate mental illness. And that became, of course, IPS. And in Australia, of course, IPS operates here mainly within the Headspace organisations. So consequently, it reaches only a small cohort of people that have a referral inside that. And the evidence suggests that about 4% of people that have mental illness that are pursuing employment are able to access IPS type programs. We've developed a satellite version of it for non-clinical settings, and I'll talk about that later on. And we're starting to see that not just here, but also globally as well, because if you look at the cohorts that are accessing disability employment services today, they are significantly now people with some form of mental illness or psychiatric disability. So the actual term customized employment itself came about in the year 2001, when under Bill Clinton's administration, they gathered a whole bunch of people together, around 27 people from memory, who were delivering what was then known as person-centered employment practices. That included people like Mike Callahan and Carrie Griffin, Dave Hamers, Rich Luking, David Mank, etc. So it was a mixture of academics and ex-university people that were practitioners. And they got together to say, okay, what are we doing? And what they essentially found was they were pretty much doing the same thing. And they had various versions, but essentially the same thing. And that process is what was called discovery. They came up with the term customized employment. And I think from memory, Chris Button from ODEP, or the Office of, which now the Office of Disability Employment Policy, came up with the term customized employment. And Mike Callahan, he decided he would call his version of discovery, what he was doing, discovery. The Griffin Hamers guys, they call theirs discovering personal genius. So that, you know, so what eventually you end up with is a situation where there are variations on discovery, which is essentially a person-centered employment practice. And I think one of the things that you've got to remember about discovery is that the processes themselves of discovery were also designed to reflect the US funding model, which is the same with the whole customized employment process. It reflects their funding system. If you look at the discovery fidelity scale Griffin Hamers people developed, about half of it is focused on funding. And that's because in the US, they have multiple layers of funding. We don't have the same issues in Australia because we essentially have one layer of funding, and we're actually quite well funded for disability employment. So what we did at the centre through our practice, for our research, we started to modify the US document. In actual fact, we have a version of based on the Griffin Hamers one, which we have a technical alliance with Griffin Hamers. We've modified it to reflect our setting, the NDIS and DES, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on. But it's important to recognise that that discovery in the US is done a little differently to discovery in Australia, simply because our legislation and funding mechanisms are different. So it's, in that sense, it's customised to Australia, it's contextualised to Australia. In 2014, under the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act, they actually created a legal definition of customised employment discovery, and that is this definition here, which is competitive integrated employment for an individual with a significant disability that is based on an individualised determination of the strengths, needs and interests of the individual with a significant disability, and is designed to meet the specific abilities of the individual with a significant disability and the business needs of the employer. And that's what we call mutuality. And if you look at any of Rich Luking's research and certainly his book, the focus is on mutuality, because at the end of the day, it's not simply about will you employ someone, because the only reason to employ someone is that you is if you have abilities or skills that we can exploit to make income. Because if you don't have income, you can't pay your wages. So as harsh as that might seem, none of us that are viewing this or will view this are employed because we look pretty or whatever. We're employed because we create value in the form of income for our employer, which allows them to pay the wages. Okay, it really is as simple as that, as harsh as that might sound. So in 2018, Katie Inge, recently retired again from VCU, got together a whole bunch of practitioners, people like Carrie and Mike, et cetera, et cetera, went, okay, so what are the defining practices of customized employment? What is it? What does it look like? And they reach a consensus on 12. And the 12 are this: physically meet at a location of the individual's choice. Yeah. Usually that's the client's home, and certainly we start with probably 95% of our clients, we start at their home. Why do we start at the home? Because that's where people surround themselves with the things that they like, that interests, the things that allow us to kind of go, you know what, that's a really interesting thing. I wonder if that is transferable to an employment setting. It's about building rapport and get to know the individual. Mindfully listen to the person. In other words, let the client talk, right? We're not there to talk and talk and talk. You've almost got to be a bit of a therapist, which is kind of nail your mouth closed, or sew it closed, whatever, and really listen. It's about identifying the individual's interests, their skills, and their abilities. And this is where the process is about, you know, if you look at discovery, it's about starting with, what are the things someone likes? Okay. Now, likes are great. We all have likes. Likes are probably not the things we want to do for a living. But interests, they're the things where people may want to say, okay, these are the things that, these are my interests, and these are things I might want to do for a living as, you know, a job. And it's about taking those interests and using that to guide the job development process, shall we, as it is. It's about uncovering the skills and emerging abilities and things that can be built on. It's about conducting in-depth interviews with the family and friends concerning a person's interests, skills, and abilities. And this is, people kind of go, well, you know, why do I want to talk to other people? And this point five is an actual fact, part two of discovery, or the second part of discovery, or if you like, the second of the four components that make up customized employment. What we find is that families know a lot about their child, their sibling, the person, but the extended family, friends, also know a lot, and often things that families might not know. Because, you know, the thing, when you live with someone, you tend to sort of not see all the other things they do, you know, their other abilities, their other interests, their other skills. You know, for me, the perfect example is I knew what my wife used to do for a living, but I never understood it and I never saw it. And when I did go and watch her work occasionally, I would go, oh my God, she has these amazing skills. But I didn't see, I don't see them at home. Why? Because we're not working at home. She's, her work is somewhere else. We're at home being a family. So it's about also observing the person in daily activities in several different community settings, right? And what are we trying to do? We're trying to see how people react and whether there are things that they do, have skills, abilities, and whether they're contingent on certain environments. And that goes to the point of trying to find a person's ideal conditions of employment, their ideal setting for employment, where the job makes sense for them. It's about arranging for the job seeker to observe local businesses that match their interests, their skills, and their abilities. It's not about going shopping. You know, if a client says, I have an interest in fashion, we're not going out to try clothes on all day. What we're doing is we're going to a business and getting the client to maybe do a few things in that business, you know, and you might think, well, how do we do that? Well, you could go into most places that sell clothes and there'll be stuff everywhere. There'll be a rack of stuff all out of the place. You can simply say to the client, okay, does this make sense to you? They go, no, these sizes are all in the wrong order. And you can simply go, well, what would you do with that? And they could show you or even, you know, tell you what to do it. So you start to see things without really interfering with the business you're visiting. It's about conducting informational interviews of employers at local businesses that are representative of a person's interests, their skills, and their abilities. And informational interviews are really just a discussion with a purpose with a business. And to give you an idea, I recently went out, last couple of informational interviews that I've done, I went out with a staff member of an organization with a client. And the client had, it had been identified, their interests and their skills were about outdoors. They had an interest in horticulture. So we'd identified some businesses in the local area in that field. We went and visited to do information. It was brilliant. And I even brought another grevillea for my garden, which is what I tend to do. You know, so that was fine. And then the second business we went to, same sort of horticulture business, with the client, walked through the door, identified some people that we could have a conversation with. That was 3 weeks ago. That particular second business, the client's been working there for 2.5 weeks because he was able to have a conversation with a purpose. And what we discovered was that there were vacancies there. And it matched the client perfectly, you know. So informational interviews in many ways are not simply about building social capital and exploring it. It's also about opportunities for work experience and for employment. Point nine of the characteristics were to observe the job seeker engaging in job-related tasks. You know, sitting in a room, building, writing a resume and this sort of stuff is not a job-related task. You need to take the client into environments where it makes sense for them. I took a young man into a audio recording place where they sell recording gear a few weeks ago because he had an interest in recording, and what did we discover? A whole range of things. But the beaut thing about that particular one was the young man was so enthusiastic about what he saw that he turned around to his employment consultant and he said, I'm going to do this from now on. All I want from you is to identify places that make sense for me based on my interests, and I will go and do informational interviews myself. Now, how cool is that? The client took control of the process. It's about collaborating with the job seeker, their family and friends, and confirming the job seeker's interests, job interests, skills and abilities. And the really thing point there is, it talks about family, and this family is mentioned in a number of things here. Family are very, very important. You cannot do this without engaging and communicating with the family on a regular basis. It's one of the things that I'm constantly saying to my staff. You really need to engage and keep the family in the loop. It's about negotiating a customized job description. And when you look at that, customized job description, or sometimes referred to as job customization, it's an accommodation. At the end of the day, a customized job or a customized job description is about an accommodation. And it's an accommodation that has to work for not just the client, but also the business owner. So they were the 12 characteristics that they consensually agreed to find customized employment. My cursor back and we're in the right direction. We did. Okay, so what sits behind that? Right. Now, it's really interesting because you can see that they've identified those 12 characteristics, but there's got to be some standards. And quite a few years ago now, in the US, they established the Association of People Supporting Employment First, or APSE, and they developed a set of competencies around delivering employment support. And to be certified as an employment support professional, you see the initials there, you get examined across 150 areas and you need to have an 80% pass rate. But before the assessment, you've got to access one of the ACRE-approved training courses. And ACRE is the Association of Community Rehabilitation Educators. It was set up by the organisations like Griffin Hamis and Transcend, et cetera, Mike Callahan or Mark Golden Associates, to create their own accrediting body because it wasn't one and isn't one in the States. The equivalent here is ASQA, and I've spent 3-4 years trying to convince ASQA that disability employment is a profession and they wouldn't have a bar of it, and they continuously reject that. Now, that will probably change in the not-too-distant future because the Bureau of Stats and the Tax Office are creating a category for the disability employment professional, and hopefully that will change ASQA's attitude. We might be able to progress that a little bit forward. So in America, there's about 18 organisations that are recognised as having training programs for supported employment. So in Australia, the equivalent in Australia, of course, there wasn't one. And of course, because of our association of Griffin Hamis and various organisations, and of course, being a member of APSE as well, we set out to replicate and contextualise what they do in America to create programs in Australia around discovery and customised employment. And of course, you can see these are some of the programs that we have at the centre. We have our non-clinical version of IPS for non-clinical profession for people who work in non-clinical settings. The big one, of course, is the Certified Customised Employment Professional, which is the entire box and dice, the basic certificate program in job development, person-centred employment. And this is one of quite a number of programs that we have at the centre. So they're the equivalent. They do match up to the APSE standards, but of course ACRE is an American organisation, so there's no accreditation other than ours. And you know what? We've been doing customised employment long enough and working with the people long enough to know what it takes. So what's the underpinning knowledge for customised employment? And if you look at the training, and this is what we train in Australia, it's been contextualised to our setting, which is very important. And if you look at it, stage one of the program, which is discovery, and that focuses on the individual understanding their likes, interests, and the concepts are in there are the origins of customised employment, the advantages, the steps involved in undertaking stage one of discovery, and our version of it is called the individual discovery record, and that's about to evolve a little bit further based on some of our recent research and guidance from the States. And of course, we'll be doing that next week at our annual retreat. We'll be actually evolving the discovery record. Includes the basic social capital. Social capital is, in my view, one of the most underrepresented aspects of customised employment in Australia. Very, very important. And we do a lot of work in that area. So that's what stage one is. Stage two is about identifying the skills in the workplace and using work experience to underpin skill development and identify vocational pathways. And that includes things like informational interviews, how to engage with the family, work experience, self-determination and self-advocacy, and of course, stage two of the individual discovery record. Self-determination and self-advocacy, I'm going to talk a little bit more on a little bit later on because that's really key. Discovery, as it says there, is two stages, stage one and stage two, the individual and then the family. And then, of course, we get to stage three of customised employment, which is job development. And this focuses on the unmet needs in the workplace, matching participant skills and interests to a business culture and setting. Culture is super important. It's one of the reasons people don't survive in a workplace is because of the culture. Some of the key concepts we discover, we work through in the job development program are understanding job development and engaging of employers, promoting employer and employee mutuality, delivering post-employment supports and systematic instruction. And systematic instruction, many of us have heard of Mark Gold's Try Another Way, which Mark developed in California through the 70s and 80s, and unfortunately Mark passed away. But most people are familiar with systematic instruction. The thing about systematic instruction is there are about 20 different variations or versions of it, and the Mark Gold one is just one of them. And probably, you know, whilst we teach systematic instruction in Australia, I'd always defer to June Alexander, who is the most researched and expert on systematic instruction. It's her thing, and she'll actually be talking about it next week at our retreat. But that's June's thing, and I'm always happy to let June do it and be her guinea pig in her training, which is kind of funny. But anyway, part four of the training in customized employment is about supporting family, support funding, activating families and self-employment. And it's a focus on understanding how to fund the employment journey, the various supports to consider, the role of benefits planning. That's particularly important in the States, also important in Australia, because we know a lot of people will go, I don't want to work because I'll lose my disability support pension. So you really need to do the numbers so that you can illustrate to people the advantages of working and its impact on their various benefits. So we look at understanding benefits, counselling and support funding, the role of families and friends. We look at self-employment and business planning. So they're the primary characteristics of the customized employment training program. So what does customized employment look like in practice? Well, it looks like this. Stage one is all about the individual, their likes, their interests, emerging skills and abilities. It's about moving from likes to interest to get some direction for employment. Stage two is about friends, neighbours, family. What hidden abilities and strengths do they know about you? What do they know about the client that can confirm potential employment pathways? Job development, which is about where we use our vocational themes to guide job development. And job development, it's a multi-stage process that operates on a number of levels, and I will come to that a little bit later on. Post-placement planning and support, this is the area where invariably employment fails. But it's important that customized employment isn't about setting and forgetting. It's about planning the final stages and to ensure the proper support and conditions for the client and the employment. True mutuality, it's about having a clear understanding, the wages, who's going to support, who's going to be the mentor. There's a long list. And within stage four of our discovery or program, quite hones in on, and there's quite a few things in there, and I make no apologies for the fact that it is quite pointed about you need to tick these boxes to make sure these things are in place so that employment makes sense and has longevity. Okay, so that's kind of what it looks like in practice. Very simple, but at the same time, there's a complex set of knowledge that sits behind it. So let me talk about job development. And job development is quite funny. It's not funny, actually, but it is. A little while ago, I set out to write a practice guide for job development. When I started doing the research, what I discovered was that there wasn't a lot of research around it. So what I did was I had a chat with Trevor Parmentor in Sydney, my mentor, and the centre's patron. And I went, I can't find a great deal of evidence for job development. And he said, well, because there isn't a great deal. I spoke to David Mank, who is with ODEP now, but is formerly was the head of at Indiana University and worked with Rob Horner in his early days in Oregon. I spoke to David, said the same thing. He said it's on you to actually write the work on the evidence and build an evidence base. Spoke to Tim Rison at Utah State, got the same thing. Spoke to a whole bunch of my colleagues globally, and I got the same thing. So what I thought would be a 2-week exercise of research right turned into actually a little bit more than that. But what I realized was that we needed to create a hierarchy. And that hierarchy consists of understanding the client, understanding the employer, job analysis, task analysis, and then to job creation and carving, which in many ways is an accommodation. And then, of course, at the end of it, the top of the pyramid is the workplace accommodation. Yes, it's a little inverted, but why does this look like a pyramid with the client at the bottom? Because you know what? There's a lot of work at the bottom. That's why it's broader at the bottom. So we did that work. We did that research. We produced a guide for it, which I then had peer reviewed. And it's, I just pressed that button. And of course, it's doing quite well. Again, it's something that we teach job development by itself as a separate entity or as part of the program. So that's what I wanted to say about job development. So let's talk about discovery in Australia. The thing about discovery, and I think it's really important, you know, and that's one of our guides there, but it's really important. If you think about discovery, don't think about it as just finding information about the client. You need to look at discovery and treat it as a capacity building exercise, right? Don't simply think about it as going from A to B and there's a job at the end. It is a capacity building exercise. And it's really important if you keep it that in mind, because it also goes to how the NDIS support discovery.
I'm really trying to do too many other things. So. Good.
Could you mute yourself, please? Thank you. It is a capacity building program. It's not simply about employment. This is why there are work experiences part of it. We know from experience and research that work experience builds skills, and those skills are never lost. Okay. So it is a capacity building mindset. So keep that in the back of your mind when you're looking at discovery. So what you're looking at there are some of the things that sit behind customized employment. Okay. Now, a lot of this stuff you can download for free from our website, a lot of it is our guides. But the beautiful thing about discovery, in particular the process, is that it has application across a broad range of areas. That program at the top called Glide In is our school transition program. It is based on group guided discovery. Group guided discovery came out of the juvenile justice system in America, and it works very well. We're using it in a number of schools here in Melbourne at the moment. So when you start to look at this, what you start to see is it is very much about building the client's capacity. Why is building the client's capacity important? Because if you think about the NDIS, for example, the NDIS is predicated on choice and control. Choice and control, in many ways, is having the capacity to self-determine and having the capacity to self-advocate. In other words, having a voice and knowing when to use it. Things that we take for granted, that many of the people that we support have never had the opportunity to do that. So we need to work on that. That's why it is capacity building. You can see these the three posters there, discovery stage one, stage two, and stage three. The stage three one is about to be broken into two stages to reflect the training. Okay. Now, important thing to remember is there is more than one discovery. There is the individual discovery, which what we've just been looking at. There's self-guided discovery, which was developed by Bob Nemec, who was part of Griffin Hamis and one of the founding people behind APSI in the US. And what Bob refers to it as minimally guided discovery. And I think there's a video on our YouTube channel of Bob talking about that. And it's for the client that's quite heavily, highly motivated to do the work themselves. And we see individual and self-guided works right across a broad spectrum. Group-guided discovery is really interesting. Group-guided discovery works in the DES system, right? Believe it or not, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But as I said, it came out of the juvenile justice system where clearly, you know, inside a facility, people are working together. So they developed its methodology and it became, you could almost argue that it's a peer-supported process. All right. So there's more than one discovery. There's the individual, which most people are familiar with. There's the self-guided, which most people probably haven't come across. And group guided, they might have, but they're probably not sure how to use it. But group guided discovery is really good. It's the program that I'm using at the moment. So let's look at the NDIS. And this is really interesting because, you know, for quite some time, people have said the NDIS doesn't support customized employment discovery, but that's a nonsense. It always has, because remember what I said earlier on? If you look at discovery as and customized employment as a capacity building process, you then start to see how the NDIS supports customized employment and discovery. It's only in recent times where they put discovery onto their little list in their supports, but it's always been there because it is a capacity building program. And at the end of the day, what's half of the NDIS? It's about capacity building. So that was a bit of a myth. Some people still kind of say that, but the truth is that's rubbish. The NDIS have always funded customized employment discovery. You just need to know what that looks like. So here's some of the line items, and this is still current. I know there's a new pricing guide coming out next week, and most of us probably went to Mary Hawkins' talk over the last couple of weeks around the school leaver employment support and how that's changing. But this is current as of today. It might not be current tonight. But these are some of the line items that you can actually use. And, of course, the employment line item, workplace assistance, it actually mentioned discovery. And you can see it talks about, you know, exploring what work would mean for a person, essential foundation skills, which you can get through work experience, managing complex barriers to obtaining and sustaining employment. And that's with a lot of clients that we work with. We actually have a small employment service called Work First, and which is also has a mental health clinic. And we work with fairly complex clients. So we do a lot of work around those barriers. Specialized job customization, which again, if you start to think about job customization, the last thing you want to do with an employer these days is to go, hey, can we create a job for someone? Because really what you're signaling is this person can't do the work. But if you do discovery correctly, you will end up in the right place where customization doesn't necessarily have to happen. There are organizations in Australia that do nothing but job customization as part of their service, and they do quite well with the cohorts of clients that they work with, and that's fine, because from my perspective, it doesn't matter what we do. We're able to find employment for people by varying what we do, and I'm all for that, quite frankly. So at the end of the day, it's about improving employment outcomes. You can use that to support a transition from an ADE to open employment or social enterprise, as they're now called. Develop a career plan, that you use it as this. Capacity building supports. You don't necessarily have to engage with a DES. More often than not, if you discover it correctly, you will land in employment. So that's one line item. We don't use that a lot in our work, and that's pretty dictated by the clients that we work with. Okay. The school leaver employment support, or YES, as it will become known when it's all tried and tested, and we know that in the next week or so, it will actually have a dollar figure in that line item. One of the interesting things about the school leaver employment support funding was that it was never funded on a weekly basis. It was never $400 or $500 a week. That was a myth that was created and came out of Canberra, a bunch of planners in Canberra. In 2017, I was commissioned by the NDIA to do a review of the school leaver employment support program. Found a lot of interesting things. Primarily, they wanted me to kill the myth of the $400-something a week thing. I can tell you, to be brutally honest with you, none of our clients are on $400-something a week. The new methodology that will come out in the funding is what we've always used, because at the end of the day, this is about the client. So the changes to SLES, which is a horrible acronym, will be quite welcomed by us in the next week or so. Capacity building line items such as employment-related assessment and counselling. Now, that line item was put in there initially to work with employers and individuals. You can use it to educate employers. But what we find with a lot of the clients that we work with, most of our clients have significant issues around employment and employment places. So that actually dictates also the type of staff that you might want to have. Because of our program, almost all of our employment staff are qualified counsellors, degree qualified counsellors. So that allows us to actually do the mental health work as well. So that's a very good line item. If you have complex clients that need that support around behaviour, around mental illness, etc. So that's an item that we use as well. Another item that is commonly used in multidisciplinary teams, which you need to get permission from the NDIA to use, but we use this from time to time. And again, it's dictated by the staff that you have and their qualifications. So again, as it says there, it's a capacity building line item. Now I'm going to go a little bit quicker so we don't run out of time, as I would like you to have the opportunity to ask questions if you like. So discovery and dares, and a lot of people say it doesn't work. Well, guess what? It does. And it works this way, using group guided discovery and then working with the clients to understand the client, to produce a blueprint. Now, that blueprint is an outcome of discovery. We use it with our clients in discovery, but it's brilliant with doing group sessions with clients in the DES system, working for that, because you know what we find is most people have never had to think about whether they have someone to support them on an employment search. Most of the clients have no idea what their skills, their personality traits are and the things they can do. They have no idea about the sort of accommodations they can use, because you know why? No one's ever asked them. You know, if you say to people, so what things do you have to offer to an employer? The program I'm doing at the moment with Adairs, none of the clients can answer that. So we spent 3 days working on that. We spent 3 days having them go out and see, talk to people in their life to get them to say, you know, what do they see when they look at you and the things that you could offer? And what we found was that a lot of people had no one in their life to support them. Once we work through all of these things, these abilities and the skills they have, which they'd never put a label on, they didn't even know, but they have things that they can offer every employer. We're able to identify, by identifying these skills and attributes, emerging themes where we could kind of go, well, you know, maybe we should be talking about this employment place. And most of them discovered that there were places that they'd never thought of before. The sort of conditions of employment, the accommodations. Now, this program at the moment has been going for about a month now, where I've been working with the staff and the clients, because it is a pilot and the first time. We're seeing a lot of things that we kind of expected and didn't expect, but importantly, we're getting outcomes. And that's important, because the thing about this is that clients are taking control of the process. And that's what you want in a DES system. You want the clients heavily engaged and involved and leading it, rather than you trying to do everything in the limited amount of time that you have. Okay. By the way, I'm more than happy to talk to people about anything we're discussing today at length at another time. So practice, this is what we do. This is the work first model, how we work. And the important thing that we find, and this has evolved through research and practice evidence, you know, you get a copy of this so you can look at this in detail, but you can see that basically discovery, job development, maintenance, or post-placement is pretty much similar. But the important thing is where we start. And we find that we have some of our clients are quite complex. And in recent, probably over the last 2 years, we've had probably only two clients that we couldn't work with. And that was simply because of the nature of their disability and the barriers they had. And they, in many ways, illustrated why employment counselling is important, because these clients were definitely not ready for employment. One client had access to weapons and liked killing things. I found that was a little bit difficult for my staff to work with, because he had untreated schizophrenia. That's a client that we needed to, in real terms, refer on, which we did, to a psychiatric centre, and another client that we've just recently had to move on because they had a considerable set of behaviours that really needed psychiatric support rather than what we could do within our practice. Even though we have psychologists working for us, it was something that required more in-depth treatment before employment would be possible. That's the workforce model.
Okay, I'm good. Bianca?
Can you mute yourself?
They had new work up.
Yes, they
know
that. Yeah.
Mute, please.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what our practice looks like, and that informs our research as well. Our training, of course, we have our training programs. There are about 18 on our college website, which you can have a look at your leisure, but they cover all the things we've been talking about today, micro courses, more detailed courses. So this is more a little bit about how you're going to access more of the knowledge. We do research, collaboration, publication, events. Our annual retreat, Customized Employment Retreat, is on next week in the Yarra Valley, which is still open, whether you want to come for a couple of days or a day. It's not a conference. It is a retreat where we go dig quite deeply through purposeful discussion. Our research, of course, there's some of the more recent papers that have been published. We have an occasional newsletter called Practice Notes, which you can subscribe to by just giving me your details. And, of course, we run online and face-to-face training. We have in November a half-day intensive on job development, which will work through the job development pyramid. And, of course, we have our technical alliances. I can see I've taken up 52 minutes of our hour. So what I might do is we might turn on the chat and see if anybody has any questions. Oop, I've got it there. So if you have any questions, pop into the chat now. And that's the simplest way. And I can answer them from there right now. And at the same time, everybody will get a copy of this presentation, okay? So if you have any questions, let's have a look at them. If you don't have any questions, that's fine. We can sit here and look at me in silence for a couple of minutes. You don't want to do that. No questions? Yep, no doubt about that, Colin. The program itself, because it is the nature of that program, and we're seeing that, but group guided discovery will work in the DES system. It's as simple as that. With the pilot we're doing at the moment, we're seeing the things that I thought we would see, and some of that is because of the time constraints on the clients, but at the same time, it's also changing the culture as well, which is going to be a big shift. But I think that, you know, Colin, people like you and I, we can change that, okay? Yeah, absolutely. We do need to bring that in. I think what needs to happen, you know, if you've worked in the DES system for any length of time, and certainly my experience of it was that I came into it during DEN and then into DES and left after a period with the peak body. But we need more flexibility in the system. It's not necessarily about linking up, you know, the NDIS to DES and that sort of stuff. This is about the client. It's about taking away some of the client compliance and giving the DES staff the time and opportunity to go out. Now, this is why group guided discovery is working, can work in DES, because it's about empowering the client to do the work. And that's a real key thing going forward, okay? I can see Phil, you know, asked the question about left in the dark under the DES system. But, of course, you know, you've got to remember, and if you read the one of my research papers, one of the things I've observed looking at the progression of from our various systems through DEN, through to DES, and where we are now, is that what we've done over decades is rather than sitting back and going, how do we change this system and create a better system? All the governments, successive governments, have done is layer more policy and more procedure on it, which has basically completely encumbered the system and to my mind, made it really unworkable. I mean, it's supposed to be a person-centered system, but where is that? If you work in the DES system, you're probably scratching your head going, I can't see it. And it's simply because of the nature of the system, the time constraints the staff have them. And to be brutally honest, you know, in my research and interviews with DES staff all over Australia, one of the things that has been driven out of it because of the compliance nature is the disability knowledge. And I think that was evident in the Royal Commission, where people often reference the fact that the disability knowledge is gone, and it has, but that didn't happen overnight. That's the layering of policy and compliance on the system. It got to that point where, in many ways, it has many of the characteristics of the Workforce Australia program. And you can see that, given that about half the participants in mainstream employment have a psychiatric disability. It's a good question, Colin. Yes, it is. It's quite resource intensive, but I would say to you that the process of embedding something like group guided discovery in your clients, where the clients are doing more of the work rather than sitting there saying, all I get is a bad experience, it's really the time that creates that bad experience, or the time constraint, in my view. But if you work with the clients in small groups, and I've worked with a group of 12, and that's what I'm working with at the moment, 12 clients, I think you can more than adequately work with groups of two or three clients. I'm one of the staff members I'm working with at the moment. We're putting together a group of three, which we're going to work with three. We're going to take them through the blueprint process, because that's one of the things that DES has done very well over the years, is it's been able to work in groups, you know. So why not take advantage of what we can do and use it to empower the client so they discover more about themselves, so they then drive the process, so that it isn't simply about a resume and applying for jobs. That's not going to get us anywhere. And you could argue that it does, but let's be honest, if you've got unchanged results over 40 years, it doesn't work. But empowered clients will. And that, I think, is the key going forward. It's the reason why a number of us were engaging with the department, because it is about, we need to change how things are done. Yes, I know the government has to have compliance because that's all about the money, but we can't lose sight of the fact that this is about an individual and their future. And we need to give the staff the tools and the time to do it properly. I'm rambling on there. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to ask? Or have I worn everybody out? So what I might say again, shameless plug, our annual retreat is on next week out in the Yarra Valley, which is a think tank. We've been holding it for, 8 years now. It's very, very much modelled on the programs that I attend in the States. But it is a conversation of purpose over 3 days. You'll find details on our Facebook page and in the social media. Come make it for 3 days, come for a day if you like. But what we're doing next week is we're pulling discovery apart on day one, and we're going to start to, with the participants that are there, we're going to actually embed into it, into the program itself, outcome markers and measures to improve the quality of the process itself. And at the same time, that's the first day, we're going to talk about the evidence for discovery and customised employment. Tim Ryson from Utah State University will join us on Zoom to have that discussion. On the second day, we're going to actually look at the staff, and we're going to look at the service provision and how that can be changed to allow for customised employment discovery to happen. June Alexander is going to have a chat about her research around what she's found with staff and clients and capacity. Mary Hawkins will join us in the afternoon again for a in-depth discussion around what they'd like to see from us into the future. And then, of course, we will then continue our process of looking at the service provider model and what we need to do and what we can do to influence the change in that. And then, of course, our last day, which is Thursday morning, we will then talk about the future, where we need to go up research, partnerships, collaborations, and we'll finish it off at lunchtime with a barbecue. So, you know, if you like the Yarra Valley, join me next week. November, of course, we have our training on job development, which is a half-day program. You can access all of these programs online, but at the same time, I'm doing a half-day webinar. And of course, all of our programs are available either online or face-to-face, should you so desire. So, Colin, yes, I look forward to seeing you next week. Bring your thongs and a hat, because it is formal. So we'll leave it at that. The recording of this will be made available to everyone And if you have any queries, my details are there. If you want to see what we do at the centre, by all means, have a look. Thank you for those that attended today and could make it. For everybody else that wasn't available today, you will get a copy of this. And as I've said, my details are there. By all means, email or ring me, and I'm more than happy to discuss any aspect of disability employment with you. Okay. Thank you, Graham. Nice to finally catch up. We'll see you next week. Thank you, everyone. And we will end our program there. Thank you, everyone.